Louisiana Eats is brought to you with support from Zatarain's, maker of New Orleans pantry staples like Creole mustard, fish fry, and jambalaya mix since 1889. Recipes and more at Zatarain's.com. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. One thing is certain about New Orleanians, we don't like change. After all, this is the place where you can dine at one of several restaurants over a century old, where the trout meniere looks and tastes exactly like the first you were ever served, perhaps dining with your grandmother decades ago. And best of all, it's highly likely that the same waiter who served you and your grandmother will still be there to take special care of you. That just doesn't happen in other places. Yet, despite our love for tradition, things do change here. So this week's episode is dedicated to all the things we love that just ain't there no more. Brian Batt and Katie Danis join us with memories of Pontchartrain Beach, the amusement park founded by Brian's grandfather that entertained generations of New Orleanians for over 50 years. While we're mourning the loss of all that fun, we'll celebrate the rebirth of Hubig's Pies, a beloved treat that's been missing from the scene since a tragic fire in 2012. We're taking a delicious trip down memory lane on this week's Louisiana Eats.
Hi, I'm Brian Batt.
And I'm Katie Danos.
And together we wrote the book Pontchartrain Beach.
A Family Affair.
Yes.
We won't do this the whole interview.
Longtime friends and business partners, Brian and Katie share a love of antiques, art, and all things Big Easy style. They co-own Hazelnut, a home furnishings boutique on Magazine Street, and previously collaborated on a book about New Orleans design.
And we still love to do other projects together.
Other projects together. Yeah. We still, you know, she's like my sister from another mother.
So when Brian went through his late mother's belongings and discovered endless memorabilia about his family's amusement park, he reached out to his partner in crime. Together, they researched and wrote Pontchartrain Beach, A Family Affair.
We really enjoyed the process of doing it really full on together. We holed ourselves up in Katie's home and did it. It was something.
Joining us in the Louisiana Eats studio, both Brian and Katie shared what they learned about the Batt family's beachfront amusement park. We began with its founding in 1928 by Brian's entrepreneurial grandfather, Harry, who started his career working in the family's humble ice business.
Like I say in the book, my grandfather was an ice man and he overcame it. He was a visionary.
Right.
And he just... And
he was resourceful.
Resourceful. And mm-hmm.
And persistent.
And persistent. And like one of my favorite things we discovered, he said, what was it? An obstacle is just an opportunity.
Right.
The story goes is one time he was delivering ice on a horse-drawn carriage going down St. Charles delivering ice. And on the other side, he saw a refrigerator being delivered on a Model T and said, whoops, I got to get out of this business. And
now, I don't know if I believe that he would ever have been happy and fulfilled just being the Iceman.
No.
I think he had a personality for entertainment.
Well, he wanted to go to Hollywood.
Right.
He wanted to go move to California and try to get into the movie business. And it was my grandmother that said, no, you don't. You have a child and a wife and another one on the way or, you know, around that time.
Right.
And she also said, your hair's thinning and look at your nose.
Oh. So he goes to his father and sweet talks him into leasing an arcade amusement park sort of
That was not doing so well at the Spanish Fort.
Right, it was one of the places that they delivered ice. He's observing, which I think he was a fantastic observer. And he was observing these rides and that could be something they could make a little extra money with and tiptoe into.
I was fascinated by that. He acquires, at that very start, the Caterpillar, the flying scooter,
The bug.
The bug.
It was the bug.
The bug that the bug stayed forever.
The entire time.
It was really the Chicago World's Fair in 1933 that sort of changed your grandfather's world vision.
Mm-hmm.
I think so, because that was a major, it changed a lot of people's visions. It was a major World's Fair where they were showing new technology and they presented the Zephyr there.
Which was a very fast train.
Right. And also, you know, that fair was built on reclaimed land in Chicago. So he was seeing the what could be done with land with a different way than its original use.
My grandfather said, we will take sand in from Florida, right, from the Gulf Coast, and make a beach. And there will be a recreational spot.
And I will make a world-class amusement park.
Make a world-class amusement park. Mm-hmm. Swamps don't always have to remain swamps.
I love the fact that he kind of fell into the 6 or 7 rides, and then he decides, I'm going to get myself to the World's Fair in Chicago, and I'm going to learn everything I can. He did the work. He put the work in.
And he only had an 8th grade or 9th grade education.
Have fun to train me. You have fun every day of the week. You love the thrilling ride.
Awaiting you at Funville, Pontchartrain Beach.
Your grandparents, they just seemed to be destined to be together because he was a showman, but she was even born on New Year's Eve, which sort of gave her a big reason for a party.
I was fascinated by Marguerite because they married young.
Very young.
16 and 19 or 16 and 21.
Yeah.
But from the get-go, she was game. She went back and forth to the Spanish fort. All of her sisters worked at
the
beach.
Business, yeah.
And whenever he traveled, Harry went to every World's Fair, every local fair, regional fair, across to other international fairs, and she always went with.
Yeah.
She loved her modern home.
Yes.
Which was so deco inspired. And so I don't think that's typical in that era in New Orleans to pick up and go constantly like she did.
Even to be a working woman.
To be a working woman.
Well,
exactly.
She also had a suitcase always packed.
Yes.
She said, just in case Harry got the call, she was there too.
In the diaries, she'll write about helicopter rides or the newest ride in Germany. She did all of it.
And yet she's raising a family herself.
Mm-hmm.
They had two boys together,
mm-hmm.
Harry Jr. and John.
My dad.
And there was really a serious family work ethic going on because everybody worked in the business.
Harry had a very strong work ethic. I mean, it was your mother and your
Aunt Faye
that begged for the first time for the men to have a day off during season.
Yes. During season, they worked 7 days a week from 10 o'clock in the morning till 1 o'clock at night.
In the morning.
In the morning.
I just did think it was hilarious that the two wives of the sons had to go petition.
Because
there were five children between the two families
then.
And you didn't see your dad much, huh?
Never. Barely in the summer. I would go to the beach, you know, to hang out or have lunch with him. Or sometimes we'd have dinner. Or the 4th of July, we'd go on the stage and watch the fireworks. But if Dad had to be called home from work during the summer, watch out. Because we were in trouble. And during the winter, all my friends like, what does your dad do? Well, they maintained everything. They would travel to find the new rides. They would, you know,
book
everything.
The musicians.
Make sure everything was ready for the season. So it was very interesting because we never took a summer family vacation. Mom took us, but my father unfortunately never got to go with us. But it was, you know, you look back and it's like it's perfectly normal. You know, I thought everyone had a roller coaster in their backyard.
During the winter, when the amusement park is closed, it was sort of your personal playground. You got to ride your bike out there.
I would get in trouble. I mean, one time I decided I could scale the first big dip of the Zephyr. And I got almost, you know, 3/4 up when I hear my father screaming, get your down, you know, you're out of your mind.
Brian, you snuck into the beach after hours?
No, that was my brother.
That was Jay.
And he got in so much trouble. On a double date, and they went under. There was an entrance under the second dip or the first dip of the roller coaster to get into the back, you know, the back workings of the park. And I think he tipped the night doorman, to let him in because, he knew him. He went in and turned on some of the rides. I mean, at first they did the bumper cars, and then he rode the Zephyr because he knew how to work it. And my father, I think, if he didn't, he had already had a heart attack. It might have given him another one. And fortunately, Jay was grounded for the entire summer. And his—
Not just grounded.
Grounded for the entire, his entire punishment. He couldn't do anything except show up at Punch Train Beach at sunrise.
6 a.m.
And he had KP and garbage duty. Now, you can imagine what that smelled like in the dead of summer. Especially, sometimes people ride those rides and some things come up and go out. So that was his job for the entire summer. But Jay said the hardest thing was having to apologize to his uncle.
Did you ever use your access to Pontchartrain Beach to curry favor?
I kind of used it really as a litmus test to see who my real friends were. There were some kids that wanted to be my friend because they wanted to go to Pontchartrain Beach. And there are others that just wanted to be with me because, darn it, I think I'm a nice guy. And if they wanted to play and climb trees or whatever else to do, or ride bikes and everything, we were buds. But otherwise, yeah.
And your cousins, I thought they verified, and Jay mentioned this too, that they had very strict rules that they were not to cut in line.
Oh, yeah.
They were not to try to have favoritism. And they really didn't push it too hard,
right,
any more than the other employees' children. Because
exactly.
Tell about the quarters, the painted quarters. It's one of my most favorite stories.
Well, in the Penny Arcade, we would love to because it was air conditioned, and after riding over, you want to get cooled off. But we love to play the games, and they would take quarters, and mine were red and
yes.
Jay's were blue. They would paint them. So they could keep track of what was the actual money going in and out.
And same for some of the...
And some of the employees' children would get to do that too. But we could play as many as we wanted, but we could only use our colored quarters. Mine were red, Jay's was blue, I think someone else's was green.
Right. And at the end of the night, they would collect them and you would use them
again. The recycle. But it was... I look back and I look down that midway and I can just see it in my mind, all the lights and the neon and the shine and the chaser lights and the music playing. And it was just... so wonderful.
Moving on out to Pontchartrain Beach, got my baby by my side.
Moving on,
moving on out to Pontchartrain Beach, got to dig the games and ride.
After a break, Brian Batt and Katie Danos continue with Pontchartrain Beach memories. Louisiana Eats returns in a moment.
Moving on out to Pontchartrain Beach, get it all together there.
I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from Ralph Brennan's Redfish Grill, home of the award-winning barbecue oyster poor boy and 9 varieties of fresh Gulf fish caught and served daily. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 115 Bourbon Street in the French Quarter. If you're just joining us, we're talking with Brian Batt and Katie Danos, co-authors of Pontchartrain Beach, a family affair. The book chronicles stories of the Batt family beachfront amusement park. Our conversation continues with Brian's memories of a popular arcade attraction. Brian?
Yes?
Tell me about you and the stripper.
Oh, okay. The stripper was one of the games at in the arcade. And of course I loved the fortune teller and I loved the pinball machines, especially after the Who's Tommy came out and Pinball Wizard by Elton John. And there was the guy, the OK Corral guy. But kind of nestled in towards the back was this game called the stripper, and it had this little joystick, pardon the phrase, and with a little red button, and they would project somehow inside these pictures, these, you know, sexy 70s, you know, foxes. And every time you clicked on the little target, a portion of the clothes would come off. And, I mean, you think about it now, there's no way this would fly. And I just had a very quick thumb. And I was like the master of this game. And my mother got wind of it, and that game was quickly removed from the Penny Arcade. But very funny, I mentioned it, and John Georgia sent me a picture on Facebook. A PM private messaged me an actual picture of the game.
Oh, yes. My goodness. Yeah. I think you need one again. May as well just you know, think what a fun thing
it
that
was.
For
a tween boy, let me tell you, I was popular. They would gather around.
Where can you go? Family fun, let's go to Pontchartrain Beach. Good, clean, wholesome family fun, let's go to Pontchartrain Beach.
A couple of other things that really were interesting to me, and Brian and I marveled at it, was the fact that the teenage movement of that era, that there was no social media. No cell phones, no pay phones, really. And you could drop, kids would either be dropped off and picked up, but they would find each other.
Yeah.
Without a lot of orchestration, yeah, without a lot of planning.
Or meet somebody new.
Or meet somebody new.
One thing that just reminded me of one of my favorite stories that didn't make the book, it came in too late, was one of my friends from the Sacred Heart. She said, we used to ride the Sky Ride and like drop our clog at a cute guy. You know, they would drop, remember those clog shoes that everyone was wearing in the 70s? Drop it. Like, we'll be right down. Like, it was a way that they could meet the guy, which I thought was so funny.
A lot of romance.
A lot of innocence, you know, and you know, the songs that played. And just, it was just a wonderful summer experience.
We did put a poll out in social media. Tell us the summer song of your day. And the songs.
Oh, I mean, my gosh.
We would start
long,
singing.
Cool woman in a black dress.
Well,
you
got the whole list in the
book.
Yeah,
the list is in the book.
It's WTIX Appreciation Night at Pontchartrain Beach, Thursday night, August the 31st.
You'll see the greatest recording stars in person.
How in the world does it end up that your grandfather Harry throws a birthday party for Elvis at Ships Ahoy?
The first trip, Elvis played the stage in 52, was it? 55. I can't remember
on the
exactly.
Hillbilly Dumpling Tour.
He was nobody. I mean, not nobody. He had
he
a
was becoming, something, becoming something, but he was not Elvis.
He wasn't Elvis. He was not even top billing. And 4 months or 5 months later,
right.
Hound Dog hit.
Came out. Mm-hmm.
And then he was like crazy. You know, everyone was saying, oh, it's the devil's music. Oh, my God, he's shaking his hips. Oh, my God. And my grandfather's always quoted as saying, this Elvis kid is great. He's a fine young gentleman. He's just, you know, dancing and doing his thing. And later that year, Elvis had such a good time at the beach, he brought his girlfriend from.
As a visitor.
As a visitor.
And a celebrity on the Midway.
On the Midway, brought his girlfriend from Ocean Springs.
Yes.
And we had a party there. It was a big party. And, of course, my grandfather invited everybody, extended family, and my cousin Donna remembers just everyone losing their mind that
cousin,
the teenagers were just, Elvis is in the building.
And Elvis wanted fried chicken.
He wanted
so
fried chicken.
So that sort of shaped the party.
That, yeah. So
he
it was much more casual. He loved fried chicken, so that's why.
Now, everybody remembers Bally High. It was an iconic eatery. Tell me what you believe are the important stories about Bally
something
High.
Something that was a big impact on my thinking was the fact that Harry was ahead of that type of craze that really was in California. And in New Orleans, we're so traditional about our classic restaurants, Antoine's or Galatoire's as an
especially
event.
Especially at that time.
Especially at that time. And it was those are the places you would go for big events. But in just like he was always ahead of the curve or on trend, and he created this swanky, very different, come all the way out to the lake experience that was nothing. There was nothing else like that here. And it really was the cocktail set and wedding events, proms, dates. It was the place.
The place. It was a very, very, and it was also great because
the parents
could drop their kids off and then they could sit in and have these crazy cocktails. And
some
of the ingredients you cannot get anymore because I think they're illegal. But it was a wonderful, escapist, beautiful place.
I believe if you're anyone like us who are born and bred in New Orleans, who grew up with Pontchartrain Beach, you have almost a visceral reaction when you go through the pages of the book because it brings back things that you've forgotten, childhood memories.
It's very funny. People come up to us now saying, well, why didn't you call me about my story? And I'm like, I don't know you. How would I have known? You know, we had it all over social media. I think, you know, Facebook and Instagram and everything. But there are these other websites and all these other, you know, tributes to Pontchartrain Beach. And we put it out there. If you have a story or, you know, or some interesting tidbit that you'd like to share. And people really did reach out. And one of my favorite things is that they're all positive.
Thank you all so much for taking us on this summertime trip down memory lane. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
I'll go down that trip anytime with you, Poppy.
That was Brian Batt and Katie Danos, co-authors of Pontchartrain Beach, A Family Affair.
My name is David Capello, and I'm the author of The People's Grocer, John G. Schwegman, New Orleans, and the Making of the Modern Retail World.
There are many buildings across New Orleans that still bear the names of forgotten businesses. Though some of the signs that once read Schwegman's are long gone, the city's original grocery empire is not forgotten. David Capello's biography of John G. Schwegman paints the portrait of a grocer who helped to create the modern supermarket. When John G. took over his father's simple food store, people began making groceries in a whole new way. David reflected back on these early times at Schwegman's.
Well, those were unique days in the grocery store business. It was completely different than it is now. There were no real brands. There was just barrels and bags and such things for commodities, and people had to come and bring their own containers and walk to the store and walk back to their homes. And when they got to the store, they were just waited on individually by a clerk.
When John G. took the reins and opened his first giant supermarket in 1946, the experience of shopping was quickly modernized to keep up with post-war development across the country.
It was a very well-done store, and it was highly successful. And he ended up managing the store on Piety and Burgundy for almost half a century, 50 years.
That's practically an eon in retail years. The loyal shoppers of Schwegman's had plenty to get used to as John G. transformed the grocery store business. David tells us a story about one shopper's reaction to the changes.
How am I supposed to get around this puzzle garden? I want you to wait on me. There's no way I can find anything. And he handed her a bag and said, well, you're on your own now. And she said, no way am I going to do this. He's like, well, that's fine. And he took the bag and got all her things and came back and said, okay, here's your price, and I'm adding 10% service charge. And then she threw a fit. And from then on, it was self-service after that.
When John Schwegman opened the first Schwegman Brothers Giant Grocery on Airline Highway, not only was it really giant, it was filled with amazing innovations, including an air-conditioned bar located in the front of the store, where dads could cool their heels with a cold Dixie beer while mom made groceries.
He had the cheapest highballs in the country, apparently.
Oh, really?
And a lot of the locals would go out to Schwegman's to get away from the tourists because none of the tourists could even conceive, like you said, that there was a bar in a supermarket.
Along with being able to imbibe while making groceries, customers would often come across the store's live inhabitants.
Yeah, they used to have live animals that they would render for the customers. And John Francis, the son, would come in to work on a Sunday morning or whatever while no one was in there, and he could hear the bullfrogs chirping all over the store.
Was this on airline?
Yes.
The bullfrogs were saying knee-deep on airline.
Yes.
It adds to the exoticism. All of that and a cold beer right in the store, too.
Cold beer and oyster shell parking lot and all sorts of things.
Schwegman's was truly one of a kind. At the height of his success, John G. Schwegman did something most titans of industry would never do. He became satisfied with his lot.
Yeah, that's one of the great mysteries and great inspirations behind this whole Schwegman story, is that you don't really hear about that anymore these days, about deciding that you've made enough money.
After making his fortune, Mr. Schwegman set his sights on two other lofty goals, becoming a local politician and traveling the world. He began to share his philosophical and worldly discoveries with customers through his grocery store ads.
Where instead of just having a weekly ad that promotes his bargains at the store, he starts talking about his political beliefs and his morality and just whatever is on his mind. Now, he started world traveling. He had a passion for travel. He loved going on steamship voyages to Europe and eventually all over the world. So when he first started doing this, he decided to publish in his supermarket ads these kind of extended blog posts telling about his fantastic travels to Europe, and goes through like 10 different countries and talks about everything that happened, and very entertaining.
At this time, John G. Schwegman stepped back from the business, just as his son was poised to take over. Unfortunately, the changing consumer landscape signaled the decline of the stores.
Well, it took a lot more time than that to unwind. It didn't unwind overnight. And the thing about it is I think he kind of lost focus on his stores. And so when the time came for John, his son, to take over the stores, they were not at the, you know, optimal tip-top peak, and he really couldn't go on. And at that point, his son took over, who had been groomed to
He'd
take over.
He'd been in the store with the bullfrog since he was 10.
Yeah. So he was primed and ready to go. Now, he expanded outside of the city, unlike what his father had ever wanted to do. And it was great. It worked out great. And except at the same time, there was the rise of Walmart and Kmart, and they all got into the food business, and there was more supermarkets coming into the city. And so the son faced a lot more competition than the father. So anyway, he had quite the challenge to keep the store empire going.
Well, it's a sad tale, because we sure all miss making groceries at Schwegman's. I want to thank you so much for chronicling our history so efficiently and effectively, and for sharing the story of the People's Grocer with our Louisiana Eats audience. So thank you. Thank you so much, David.
Oh, thank you, Poppy.
David Capello, author of The People's Grocer.
Where's the downtown store?
Ain't there no more.
Where's the Schwegman store?
Ain't there no more.
Where's all the stores?
Ain't there no more.
What flaming drink was served to children at the Bally High? Stay tuned, and we'll answer that question when we come right back. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. I hope you'll join me for the launch of my new book, Drag Queen Brunch,
We'll get the party started at Brennan's Restaurant on Royal Street from 4 till 6 p.m. on Friday, August 30th. Everybody's invited, so stop by for a memorable champagne happy hour at Brennan's. Then, the party continues on Saturday, August 31st, when some of the beauties from the book will join me at a meet-and-greet book signing at the historic New Orleans collection at 520 Royal Street in the French Quarter. So Boo is sending Hooch Punch. Yes, that recipe's in the book too. And our next Poppy's Pop-Up Drag Brunch benefiting Crescent Care's Food for Friends program takes place on Sunday, September 8th at the Parlor at the Pontchartrain with food by Jack Rose. It's sure to sell out quickly, so reserve your spot today. Tickets are available online at theparlornola.com. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen. What flaming drink was served to children at the Bally High? It was the Flaming Zorro. Harry Bat didn't want the grandchildren to miss out on the fun, so he filled a giant tiki bowl with non-alcoholic fruit juices and then soaked half of a lemon in 151 rum and sent the entire affair flaming to the table. Of course, New Orleans children had their own flaming drink at the Bally High. I'm Poppy Tooker, and a flaming Zorro makes for good Louisiana drinks. For 90 years, one of New Orleans' most beloved brands was Hubig's Pies, a bakery specializing in fruit-filled hand pies with a glazed crust. Available everywhere from gas stations to grocery stores, locals had their pick of flavors like apple, lemon, cherry, and sweet potato. Each pie was wrapped in crinkly white paper, emblazoned with Hubig's portly pie-toting mascot, Savory Simon. Founded on Dauphine Street in the Faubourg Marigny neighborhood, the bakery managed to survive the Great Depression, World War II, and the floodwaters of Hurricane Katrina. But after a devastating fire in 2012, the company faced an uncertain future. With the news that Hubig's Pies will be back on store shelves soon, we reached back into our archives to find interviews we did with Drew Ramsey both before and after the blaze. Drew is the third generation owner of Hubig's, and when we spoke to him in 2011, he gave us some history behind the brand.
Well, there was a real man named Simon Hubig. He came from Europe at the turn of the previous century. It's widely believed that he got his start in baking, his interest in baking, because his mother worked at a bakery in Basque country, actually, literally 100 years ago. And when he came to America, he figured that he could make his fortune in the bakery business. He set up shop around government installations first. He set up his very first one in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. He was quite an entrepreneur. He effectively had franchises all across the country before that word was there, even in the lexicon. He had investors, silent partners, distribution centers, co-packing operations. I mean, we have one little bakery in the Marigny that is hard enough to keep going. You know, we do production and we do distribution. I couldn't imagine riding the train to do the end of the month inventory. But we are the only one left that has the name Hubig's. They all failed for different reasons. The Great Depression hit, and then World War II came, and they all failed except ours.
Well, thank goodness.
Well,
where would New Orleans be without Hubig's? And everything's baked fresh right there.
Absolutely.
On Dauphine Street,
absolutely.
Right?
We keep no inventory.
Wow. Give me a for instance. What's the production like on those little hand pies? How many of them a day, a month, a year?
Well, it varies by day of the week and week of the month and season. There are certain days that we just simply know we're not going to do well. We don't compete so well against free. When the Easter Bunny candy is out, our impulsory snack item perhaps suffers a little bit. When the Halloween candy is out, we don't have very good sales. But there are other times that we do very well. It's kind of funny. When there's a storm in the Gulf, people run to the hardware store and people run to the store, and I guess they view us as comfort food, and we do very well when the threat of the hurricane is upon us. But if I had to give you an average, it would be somewhere between 25,000 and 35,000 pies a day.
Drew, everybody who lived in New Orleans in August of 2005 has their own hurricane story to tell. And I was wondering, would you tell us the Hubig's Pie Katrina tale?
Well, I don't know if there is one Hubig's Pie Katrina tale, but I will tell you that if it could have gone wrong, it did go wrong for us. You know, our building, our actual bakery, suffered. The roof opened up. We actually lost some employees. But we make our pies the day before we deliver them, and our delivery day starts at about 3 a.m. So we have to anticipate what the market's needs are going to be for Monday morning, example. We cook on Sunday so that we have pies to go out at 3 a.m. on Monday morning. And if we bailed every time they said there might be bad weather tomorrow, we would have missed a great many sales days. We did make pies that Sunday. We were making production.
And Sunday, August the 28th,
correct.
You were making pies.
Yes, and Katrina was obviously worse than we thought it was going to be. And we had the pies on hand, which we still needed. If there was a mild flood or if there was an electrical failure and we had lost, say, Monday, when the stores opened up on Tuesday, we wouldn't have had product to carry to the stores. Our pies have a one-week shelf life. We don't like to make them on Sunday and sell them on Tuesday. As a matter of fact, we never do that. But we needed to have them ready for when the market opened. Nonetheless, it got terrible. We didn't have anything to do with these pies. So we just opened up the bay doors and we gave all the employees keys to the trucks and we just loaded up the trucks and we just drove around and gave out the pies. We went to the Superdome. We went to the convention center. We went to Causeway and the I-10 where people were waiting for buses, and we just gave away as many as we could. I mean, people were hungry and we had food. It wasn't a hard decision to make. But the funny thing, I think it's funny, is we gave away pies to people, and at least one told me personally, but I heard the story from other employees, that there were other people who said, I was here for whatever. I was here for Betsy. And the first thing I had after Betsy was a pie. I was at the YMCA at Lee Circle, and the pie truck came down the street and was giving out pies because my grandfather had to make the same exact decision. And when it looked like it wasn't going to get it to the market, he wanted to give it to people.
But what you did that day, you didn't just give away the pies. What else did you give away?
We gave away the farm. I mean, we gave away. we gave the trucks to our employees. Our employees that could not get themselves and or their families out, we let them take the pie truck. It was, you know, it's funny now. You know, it's funny now. But the conversation of the building is damaged and the production days run is been given away, and the vans have been driven away to we don't know where by people who we hope to see again. And so, yeah, that was, you know, when you're talking to your insurance agent, that's also an interesting situation. But we got back into business. All of our employees that we offered a job to who could come back to New Orleans came back, and we started to make pies.
And when was that? When did you get back into the pie business?
January of 2006.
There were a lot of happy people, I bet.
That was a fun time. We just made the pies, and we didn't really know even where we could sell them. A lot of the stores that we sold to previously had not come back into business. We were kind of reinventing the wheel. But we made them, and, you know, just because we're Hubigs, we actually gave away the first batch. If I don't know if you knew that part of the story, but we made a batch of pies and just gave them away.
Just gave them away.
We gave them to the fire department, the police department, the EMS people. There was still the National Guard in town. We took them to those people. We gave them to people at the hospitals. Anybody who thought they looked worthy, we just gave them a pie. What else can you do?
That was Drew Ramsey speaking with us back in 2011. On July 27th, 2012, the city of New Orleans awoke to the news of an overnight five-alarm fire at the Hubig's Pies Bakery. 95 firefighters battled a blaze that leveled the facility, including factory equipment dating back generations. What followed was a run on their popular product. Early risers who heard the news rushed to stock up on hand pies while they were still on store shelves. By the time the sun was up, locals were hard-pressed to find Savory Simon's smiling face anywhere. A week after that Friday morning fire, Drew Ramsey joined us in the studio with an update.
You arrived on the scene pretty early that morning.
Yes, I was called by our nighttime receiving guy who was there, and I got there and watched the fire and the firemen before all of the fire trucks had arrived. You know, as I think most people know, it started to engulf the building and it started to get worse, and they called in more troops and more support. I don't have the final figures, but I know that there were a lot of fire trucks and a lot of firemen by the time it all got brought under control. And they did a really good job. We're really happy that they were able to contain it. You know, we suffered a complete and total loss, but nobody's life was in danger. There's no fatalities. There's no injuries. And the neighbor's property that was damaged is fixable.
There was no one hurt, but there were people in the building?
Yeah, we don't have quite a 24-hour operation, but we have almost a 24-hour operation. And the production run for Friday sales day, we make the product all day Thursday. We cook the filling, we cook the pies, we ice them, we cool them, we wrap them, we put the orders up, and we clean up. And then there's a little bit of downtime until the nighttime receiving guy that we previously spoke of comes in and turns off the alarm and counts the orders and such. And he had done that at about 3 o'clock in the morning, and there was actually a handful of our trucks, our delivery men, that had made it in, loaded up their orders, and headed out on their routes. There were some fresh pies delivered Friday morning. It is my understanding that they didn't make it very far into their routes. You know, the customers from the day before had paged the guys and said, "We're out of pies." People stopped them in parking lots and bought whole trays of pies from them. There wasn't a whole lot of pies to be purchased at the end of the day. Once the news spread, the pie was a hot commodity? You're smiling.
Well, it certainly is even more of a Louisiana icon than it ever was before. Drew, when do you think we might be able to eat a Hubig's pie again?
The answer is as soon as possible. I have no idea. People have asked, how can I support you? And people wanted to pre-order pies, but we as a company really don't like to promise what's beyond our control. So we probably aren't going to offer a pre-ordered pie, but we are going to offer, you can certainly always buy a t-shirt. The t-shirt sales are real, and that's real support. So there's little things that you can do, but the greatest thing you can do is not forget about us. And when we get back in business, buy a pie.
New Orleans did not forget about Hubig's Pies. As Drew began rebuilding, his company was buoyed up in part by locals buying Savory Simon merchandise. When we spoke again in 2013, Drew explained how the community came together to support him and the business.
Well, it's truly unbelievable, and it was the silver lining in all of this is the thoughts, the prayers, the well wishes, the notes, the pats on the back, the hugs. Obviously, people had a very high opinion of Hubig's pies, and that means a lot. Tragedy of this level, catastrophe, would be devastating, I think, to any employer, any business, any family business in particular, and it was so for us. But when people showed up at the scene of the fire, afterwards, people bought T-shirts. The Po' Boy Festival let us set up a little booth. People came up to get a T-shirt, take a picture, tell us about how much they enjoyed the pies and that they had them at their wedding party. Or people sent them to their child who was serving overseas because that's all they wanted or something like that. Just the sheer amount of outpouring of support was truly touching.
Well, you already had a website that was up and running with merchandise on it. And obviously, people all over the country didn't realize that if they went online on your website and bought pies, they weren't going to be getting any pies.
The morning of the fire was a Friday. And, you know, they summoned us. We went down there, crack of dawn, in time to see the building fully engulfed and collapse. Getting to the website was not the top priority. And by the time we did, there was an unbelievable amount of pie orders. And
yeah,
we had to contact each one of those people and say, we're sorry, you know, it's not possible right now. And
but the response you got from those people was kind of sweet and of itself.
It was very sweet in and of itself. It was, keep the money. You need it more than I do right now. It was, don't worry about it. Send it to me when you can. It was, whatever's easier for you, even when there was a price discrepancy, not in their favor. Just people were unbelievably generous and unbelievably understanding.
And then you created an employee fund, where the money went.
We try to get everybody a refund. We try to swap out merchandise for people. There was a lot of vendors in the city that wanted to put a Hubig's Pie T-shirt on their shelf or do something for the cause. I'm actually reluctant to start to list all the ones that have done that.
Of course.
Because I know I'm going to forget somebody. But
yeah,
the Dirty Coast T-shirt shop.
Flirty Girl.
Yeah, you got to love Flirty Girl.
Got to love her.
Belladonna had a day at the spa and they gave a percentage. Again, an unbelievable amount of outpouring of support. And we started a little fund called Friends of Hubig's. And the money raised through those efforts was put into a fund. And we were able to get some money to the employees.
Well, thank you so much for doing this interview. And I am so thrilled to know that it's going to all be okay.
Well, I do think it's all going to be okay. And the support that we have gotten from every corner of this city really makes it easier for me to say that. We have gotten a tremendous amount of support, and everybody is genuinely interested in seeing this project succeed. And that makes life a little easier.
Third generation owner of Hubig's Pies, Drew Ramsey, speaking to us in 2013. After a long hiatus, Hubig's Pies is now finalizing the location for a new facility in Jefferson Parish. Production is set to begin in 2020.
I was feeling nostalgic for the days when my thoughts fit until my head from the ceiling. I remember the feeling.
That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Catch up on previous editions and hear all about upcoming special events by visiting poppytooker.com. You can find videos, recipes, and even order cookbooks there. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, and from Camellia Brand Beans. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau, and from Tableau, brunch and dinner daily with outdoor balcony dining overlooking Jackson Square. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to senior producer Joe Schreiner and special projects manager Reggie Morris. And to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. We're on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.